Parshat Ki Tetzé. We're going to dedicate this shiur to the four shlema of Netanel Ilan Ben Shena Tzipora. Netanel Felber is a chayal who was attacked by a drive-by shooting. Terrorists shot up Givat Asaf, whatever, in December. He was in very critical condition. They helicoptered into a hospital, if I'm not mistaken. He went into a coma. I don't know the full details. I know that he is still very much in rehabilitation, has a long way to go. Little by little, Shtabach Shemo, so we're going to learn Torah now in the Old City of Yerushalayim, in the merit, Bezrat Hashem. Parents of alumni of ours, Monica and David Janae, who live in Ranana, asked us to dedicate this year in honor of this chayal, that he should be healthy. I'm going to put this name on my desk, and if anyone wants to take Fittel Tillim or learn something later, that he should have good health, Bezrat Hashem. I'm going to put his picture here, and B'med he should have a refuah shleima, Bezrat Hashem. So I'll tell you a quick story. There is a little village, for reasons that will become apparent. I'm not going to tell you where it is. I'm not going to say that on a tape. It's one of the most bizarre places I've ever seen. Not far from the border, one of our borders, in the middle of nowhere, all of a sudden there's this little Arab village. And it's like in the middle of nowhere. It's like on this sandy area, and there's nothing there, for as far as you can see. And we were doing patrol in this particular area, right, on Niluim, and I had never heard of this village before. And I had been in this area, I don't know, maybe 8 or 9, 10 years earlier, actually on Niluim, and I'm pretty sure, in fact, I distinctly recall, that village was not there. And so I was trying to figure out, it was a relatively new village, it was an Arab village, there was a little mosque in the middle of it. Couldn't have been more than 50 families, 40 families. I was trying to figure out, what is this village doing here? Why did they build this here? How did they get here? You know, and there's nothing there. It would be by a river, by a factory. Nisht, gurnisht, like nothing there. And it was like one of these things, like there was so much going on at the time, I wasn't really like spending hours. I just passed it a couple times, like, what is that doing here? Nobody seemed to know. Anyway, after a few days, we found out. We found out in a very strange way. It was middle of the night, and there was a roadblock in the area. And I get a call from the roadblock that there's a guy, and an Arab, and he's got some strange kind of card with Israeli writing on it from the army, and a pistol. And he's standing at the checkpoint, and he wants an Israeli army patrol to come and take him to the Shabak, to the Secret Service. This is bizarre. And they wouldn't say all of this on the radio. They said, you need to come. And I said, what's the deal? One of our cousins is here, and he's got a gun. I figured, okay, they caught a terrorist. That's a serious issue. We've got to get there. I got to call the Shabak. He's like, so I said, Kulam Beseder, is everybody okay? Yeah, there was nothing going on. How'd you get his gun? No, he gave it to us. Guy shows up to the roadblock, gives him his gun. So I get to the roadblock, and this guy was called a Mashtap. A Mashtap is a Mishatef Pula. It's somebody who lives in whatever, an Arab area, but he's cooperating with the Israeli Secret Service. You know, you hear all the time about how they catch this terrorist and they catch that terrorist and they pinpoint some arms factory. Right? How do we do that? Because we have intelligence on the ground, right? And sometimes these people do it for money and sometimes they do it for other reasons. But, you know, and if they're really serious and they're really helping out and they're really, then they get a special card. Sometimes they'll give them a pistol. Sometimes they'll give them, like, a secret cell phone to call for an emergency. And this guy came, and basically he was convinced that people were watching him. He was convinced that people had figured out that he was Mashtap, he was terrified, he wanted to get his family out, whatever it was. So I said, look, this is way beyond my pay grade. And I took it back to the battalion. I said, I can't bring you into the base, you're an Arab, I can't bring you to the base, but stay here by the roadblock and we'll figure it out. And we eventually got to the Shabak, and Shabak Niki came, and there's a Segu Michelano, don't worry, he's one of ours, he has a car, whatever, we got this. Okay. And they put him in the jeep, and they took him off, and whatever they did, and fine. And I kind of, it was one of those weird stories that you get home for Shabbos, and you're like, I had the weirdest story, but I don't really know what it is. And that's what it would have ended up as, right? And during the process of this whole thing, I finally figured out what this village was. This was a village of Mashtapi, okay? When Israel pulled out of certain areas in Yehuda, Shomron, and Aza, today they call it Ayosh, right? They call it Yosh, Yehuda, Shomron. It used to be called Ayosh, Chevel Aza, Yehuda, Shomron. Until 2005. In 2005, you may know your history, we had a terrible experience called the Hitnatkut. We disengaged from the Gaza Strip. We removed forcibly 8,000 Jews from their homes. I'm not going to get into the politics of it. And basically Israel pulled back, and all the army pulled out of the Gaza Strip. The idea was that if we pull out, they'll have their own government, they'll stop complaining. I don't know whose idea it was. It wasn't a particularly brilliant idea. It does not seem to have worked out. Now, there were people in the Gaza Strip who were supplying intelligence and working with the Israeli army. And some of these people were terrified. Because if the army pulls out, and they're down behind enemy lines, and there were rumors that people always wondered, but when the army was there, it was a little more risky. So some of these people were such sensitive mashtapim, and they had done such sensitive work, that the Israeli army felt like, how can we leave them behind? So they pulled them out, and they basically built them a little village. And they had their own little village, and they lived in, and that's what this village was. But obviously, you know, there are Arabs all over the country. It wasn't a simple thing, and this guy was terrified. And I would have forgotten about the story. Except, a few days later, I was on patrol. And I was the officer in charge of the area when they found her. I got called to one of the most horrendous scenes I've ever seen in the army. There was a 5-year-old girl, what was left of her. And she was inside a tire. And they had left her by the side of the road near this Mashtap village as a message. And there was a sign plastered on her in Arabic. And basically it was a message to these mashtapim, your days are numbered. 5-year-old girl. It took me years to get her picture out of my head. And I remember thinking, how do you make peace with people like this? How could you ever make peace with people like this? There is a very difficult mitzvah in this week's parasha. Very difficult mitzvah. Parashat Ki Tetzé has two concurrent themes. The first theme is Ki Tetzé L'Melachama Lo'ivecha, when you go out to do battle. Right? The Jewish people say so many times a day you can't even count it. Now, trivia question, don't think about this now, but later come over to me and think you know the answer. How many times a day do the Jewish people pray for peace? Sim Shalom, Tvit HaShon Esrei, right? Oseh Shalom Ruvam Avin Kaddish, like it's unbelievable. And all we want is peace. We yearn for peace. But sometimes peace isn't going to happen, and you got to go to war. And you could make a case for saying, Bruch Atah Nechol Am Shekol Nidbaro. So from, you could make a case for saying that sometimes not going to war can actually cause war. You know, for example, in 1939, 1938, when Hitler took over Czechoslovakia, was threatening Czechoslovakia, maybe if the Allies had gone to war, there wouldn't have been a Holocaust. Right? When Hitler marched into Austria, the Anschluss, right, the Austrians didn't vote him in, broke a lot of treaties. Maybe there wouldn't have been a war if they'd fought a little war. Tough question. So on one level, this is a part of war. The challenges of war, the dangers of war, many of the halachot of war. On a deeper level, it's also what happens when you need to go to war, because going to war is not just putting on a uniform and going to an army. We fight battles all the time. You know? What in life do you make peace with, and what do you have to go to war with? There's certain things in life you have to fight. You know, laziness. You have to go to war against laziness. Laziness will destroy your life. And if you can overcome lazy tendencies, and you can battle them, and you can win, then you'll have won a very important battle in your life. And there's a certain wisdom to figuring out, what are the things I should fight, and what are the things I shouldn't fight? You know? You're at a traffic circle. I don't know what the law is in America and Israel. Whoever's in the circle has right of way. Is that true in America? Yeah. Baruch Hashem. Okay? So you're in the traffic circle, but there's a driver coming, and he's Israeli. Now, you know how Israeli law works, right? Zrizim makdim in the mitzvah. Whoever's in a hurry gets there first. So it's your right of way. He's getting there. Right? You're right. But, you know, there's a saying in Hebrew. Al tiyeh tzodek, tiyeh chacham. Don't be right. Be smart. That's a war that's not worth fighting. Step on the brakes. Let the guy by. Yishtapach shemo. That's not a battle worth fighting. So there's a wisdom in life to knowing which battles I got to fight and which not. That's Parshat Ki Tetzé. But then there's the end of the parsha. And that's about how you end the battle. And this is a very difficult mitzvah. Right? And we all know this because we read this every year. And what people don't realize is that the mitzvah of Timchet Zecher Amalek, when do we read that? Parshat Zachor. It's funny that we call it Parshat Zachor. Right? Zachorat asher asal lecha Amalek. Remember what Amalek did to you. Before we even get to what Amalek did, what's the mitzvah here? Timchet zecher Amalek. You have to erase the memory of Amalek. So which is it? Am I supposed to remember them? Am I supposed to erase them? What do? Every year on Parashat Zachor, we remember them so that we can remember the mitzvah to erase them. It's a little bit illogical. But okay. Now, you know that this parasha of Amalek appears in two different places. Where's the other place it appears? No? Kitetze is here. That's this week's parasha. Where's the other place? Bishalach. That's when the story actually happens. And there's one very notable difference between Parashat Bishalach and Parashat Kitetze. Here it says, Timche, erase. You should erase the memory of Amalek. What does it say there? Anybody remember? No? Really? Nobody has Parashat Bishalach as Bar Mitzvah? Never? Emche at Zecher Amalek. Hashem says, I will erase Amalek. Now there's a whole discussion about the difference. Some say it's about the partnership. Hashem will do his bit, we'll do ours. Some say that Sefer Shemot is Hashem building the nation. It's about experiencing the greatness of God, and therefore Hashem does everything. Parashat Tvarim is preparing to enter Eretz Israel. Now that Hashem has shown us, we have to do our bit, and we can have that discussion. That's not what I want to talk about. I want to talk about what this really means. By the way, on a halakhic framework, we are obligated to remember and to recall and to read this parasha once a year. That's according to most Mefarshim. People don't realize that if you read this in Parashat Ki Tetze, you're not obligated to Parashat Zachor. We read that to make sure and to pay attention, but if you miss Parashat Zachor, it's not Rosh Hashanah yet. So have in mind, maybe you didn't get it right, have in mind the Shabbat when they read this parasha to be Yotze the Mitzvah, Zachor et Asher Asal Chamalek. So let's read this. Zachor et Asher Asal Chamalek. Remember what Amalek did to you. Baderech, on the road. Betzetchem in Mitzrayim, and you came out of Egypt. It's interesting that it's important to remember that they did this to you on the road on the way out of Egypt. Why doesn't it just say, remember what they did to you? Asher korcha baderech. Korcha baderech is a very powerful phrase. Right? On the one hand, korcha is from the word mikre, like vayikra. Right? Happenstance. Right? If you look at the beginning of Parshat Vayikra, does anybody know what's unique about the word in a Sefer Torah in Parshat Vayikra, the first word? Hashem called to Moshe? It's a small aleph. Anybody know why there's a small aleph? It says Vayikra, but you could read it without that aleph, it would be Vayaker. And Vayaker would mean Hashem happened across. That's the language that we use for Bilam, for example. It's not the same as being called. It's the difference between being random and being called. So a little aleph is somewhere in between. Anybody know why we have a little aleph there? Because Moshe is uncomfortable with the fact that they called, Hashem called me. And he wants to write it. So there's a really weird medrash. Right? Asher korcha baderech, they happened to cross you on the way. There is another way to look at that word. And it's a chilling commentary. And this is a comment that comes from the Eish Kodesh. The Eish Kodesh was one of the last rabbis of the Warsaw Ghetto. And he gave a secret shiur every week in Parshat Shavuah. And some of the things that he says there are very difficult. And every week's parsha is dated by the year. Reading Parshat Ki Tetze from 1942, he wasn't reading Parshat Ki Tetze anymore. He was smoke in Treblinka. But the year before, he has a piece on the parsha of Parshat Ki Tetze. And he talks about Asher Korcha Baderech. They cooled you off. It made you cold. Cold. You were so on fire, and they cooled you off. You know? What really did Amalek do? That's what most people say. What did they do? What did Amalek do? What did Amalek do? We're getting out of Mitzrayim, and they attacked us. And where did they attack us? In the rear. They attacked the women and children in the rear. By the way, the Israeli army to this day has a rule, okay? If a battalion is going, is in battle, the battalion commander is in front, and the deputy battalion commander, who outranks the company commanders and the platoon, he's in back. The second most sensitive place to be is in the back, because if something happens from the rear, the back becomes the front. And that's just basic strategic knowledge. Like, every military strategist knows that. So it's kind of interesting that they didn't do that. Like, you protect your rear. You don't leave your rear unguarded. Why would you leave your rear unguarded? What do you think?
Because it was unheard of that someone would dare attack, someone that wasn't in the battle.
I don't think that's true. It's a legitimate point of view, and there are mefarshim who say it, so I'm not saying it's wrong. But that doesn't speak to me. By the way, if you study history, you see that there are many instances where marauding tribes took the women and children. They were like chattel, right? Yeah? Pardon? Who was too comfortable? Why were they comfortable? Because God just split the sea. Because 10 plagues. Because the mightiest army on the face of the earth, the Egyptian army, was vanquished miraculously. Because this people is marching with no less than the ultimate commander-in-chief. Who in their right mind would attack the Jewish people? It's unbelievable. Az namogu kol yishvei Kanaan. That's what we say in Az Yashir. Right? All the Canaanite nations were trembling. They were terrified. 40 years later, when the Jews are about to cross the desert, across the Jordan, and they send 2 spies. Remember this story? It's a strange story. And what does Rachav say? When do the spies realize, okay, this is going to work? She says, we know, we remember what you did. We remember the Egyptians, we remember the Red Sea, right? V'namogu, she uses the same language. The entire country is terrified. 40 years later. And well, they should be. How do you attack the Jewish people? Jewish people never imagined that they needed to defend themselves because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is defending themselves. So put aside the moment, for the moment, if Hashem protects them and they have clouds of glory, why it is that Amalek succeeded in doing this? How did Amalek succeed in doing this? That's not today's question. But what was so terrible about what Amalek did? Okay, they attacked. We fought a battle. We won. We didn't finish it off, but we won. Hashem says, no, not this time. Right? When Yeshua enters the land of Canaan, the Gemara says, and there is basis for this in the verses, but the Gemara says that he offers the Canaanites 3 choices. Okay? 3 choices. You can run. And if you want to escape, we're not interested in destroying you. We want to create a special place. We want to create a point of light in the world. We want to be an Or LaGoyim. We want to create a society so the world can learn what it is to have an ethical, moral society. And if you can't handle that, and you don't want to live according to our ethical rules, then you can leave, and we won't run after you. And the Gemara says that 1 of the 7 nations actually did leave. They ran. They were called the Girgashites. And according to the Gemara, they went to a place called Afriki. Where do you think Afriki is? Africa. And in the 1800s, 2 explorers in Namibia found an obelisk, and there's reference to this much, much earlier, 1,000 years earlier, right? Or maybe I'm getting my facts wrong. It was 1,000 years earlier. There's an obelisk in Namibia, and much, much later, post Rosetta Stone, they translated the hieroglyphics on the obelisk, and one of the lines in that obelisk says, "We are they that fled before Joshua, son of Nawe." That's what it says. They ran. My relationship with Torah, my emunot, they're not based on these tidbits, but they're interesting. And it makes sense. We weren't looking to destroy the Canaanites. We were looking to create a society. Now, they had another choice. They could stay and accept the Sheva Mitzvah Nenoch, and the Givonim did that. If you're willing to live in the land and not murder and not steal and live according to morality and civil court systems and not worship idolatry with all of its pagan, licentious behavior and cruelty and child sacrifice and whatever else, then there's 7 mitzvot, and you can look them up in the Gemara and Mako, right? Then you can stay. Now, if you're not willing to accept that and you don't want to run, and you say, no, I love stealing too much, or I love murdering too much, so then we can't create an ethical society if you're living next door. Then we got to destroy you. And those are the 3 choices. Run, accept 7 months of Nenach, be citizens, sort of, or fight. But we weren't interested in destroying them. Uvda, the Girgashites left, and we'd run after them. Not so by Amalek. Amalek, Pasuk says, Tinche Zecher Amalek. You have to destroy Amalek. Now listen to this. Right? Tinche Zecher Amalek. Don't just destroy them, don't just erase the memory of them. So Rashi explains, Me'ish V'Adisha, every man and woman. Me'olal v'ad yonek. From the nursing baby to the newborn. Every last man, woman, and child. And we're not done. Mishol v'atzeh. You have to destroy their cattle. You have to pulverize everything that's left of them. Shelo yehei shem amalek nizkar afilu ala beima. That there shouldn't be a cow that somebody say, oh, that's an Amalekite cow. There's nothing left to reference Amalek. Finish him off. That's a pretty difficult mitzvah. It's a hard thing to go to war. It's a hard thing to know that you might have to kill somebody. I cannot imagine being commanded to kill women and children. Could you possibly do that? Now, if this was man-made, so I'd say, okay, it was a different time or whatever, and we're done. But if you believe the Torah is divine, which I do, so then on the one hand, I can understand. Only a Kodesh Baruch Hu could tell you that you could be obligated to do such a thing. I could understand. Now, on a practical level, right, it is understandable. I suppose a society can reach such a level of evil that the world's better off without them. But what was it that they did? What did Amalek do that was so terrible? Very strange. The Rambam, by the way, in Hilchos Malachim, makes it even clear. He passes this way, Lalacha. Listen to this Rambam. Right? Hilchos Malachim is an amazing set of Halacha. I sometimes think that it's the last set of Halachot in the entire Rambam, the end of Sefer Shoftim. It's all the laws of when we come home to Eretz Israel and we appoint a king, and how are we supposed to appoint a king, and when do you build the Beis HaMikdash, and what does it mean to fight a war, and what's Mechamas Mitzvah, and what's Mechamas Rishus, and what does an Israeli soldier think of in battle? How does he behave in battle? It's unbelievable. The Rambam is writing in a cave how to behave as a Jewish soldier one day. Listen to what he says. Perek Vav Halacha Dalet, right? Vim lo yishlimu o yishlimu v'lo kiblu shev mitzvah nach. If they don't accept the seven mitzvah nach, right? V'amalek shelo yishlimu ein menichin mehim neshama. You don't leave a single soul. Shneimar kein taseh lakol, right? Lo techayek kol neshama. So the Rambam passes this way lalacha. That means that if the Rambam is right and Mashiach comes and Amalek is still around, we're going to be obligated. I'll be quite glad that I'm done with the army. I don't know how do you do that? You got to butcher every last man, woman, and child. You know the story of Shaul HaMelech. Shaul HaMelech can't do it. Agag begs him for mercy and he's broken. He just can't do it. And I understand that. Because I need to deal with this. And as an aside, it raises an interesting question. You know, we live in a society where everybody should have the right to say their piece. Freedom of speech, you know? Rashida Tlaib thinks that we should boycott Israel, and Israeli soldiers rape women and kill babies and whatever. Okay, she's wrong. It's not true. But it's an opinion. She's entitled to an opinion. Everybody has an opinion. Or do you say, you know what, there are certain opinions that don't deserve to see the light of day. You know? Josef Mengele, in 1939, should have been shot. And if Josef Mengele would have been shot, there might be millions of people who are still living today. That's an interesting question. How do you know the difference? And there are only two possibilities. One is there's a recipe, and the other is the only Kodesh Baruch Hu can tell you the difference. Right? So how do you deal with that? So there's one piece of this pasuk that I think is the clue to unlocking this whole story. Listen to this verse. Listen to this pasuk. Tell me what this reminds you of. What does this remind you of? Okay? Asher korcha baderech v'izanev b'chakon echshalim acharecha v'ata ayef v'yageh. They hit you in the back all the week and you were tired. V'lo yarei Elohim. And they were not, or you were not, fearful of God. Interesting question. Did this happen because we were not Yarei Elohim? Or did this happen because they were not Yarei Elohim? And those are two legitimate possibilities, and the commentaries discuss this. What does that remind you of? The low Yarei Elohim. Anybody remember? Yeah. Oh, that's very good. I did not think of that. Okay, that's very good. Very hot. But I'm looking for something earlier. Much, much earlier. Much more foundational, but that's good, right? Yeah? Who deals with this, yeah? Pardon? Where do you find Egypt not being Yireh Elokim? That's interesting. The what? Oh, it's just saying the way they behave. No, I'm talking about a pasuk that says, "Ein Yirat Elokim, Lo Yireh Elokim." Listen to this pasuk. See if you remember the story. What is it, Zach?
Noah?
Nope. Yep. Pardon?
Stum.
Now, I would have expected to find it in Stum. It's not quite Stum, although Stum fits the paradigm. No, this is interesting. This is a story. There are a number of places this appears, but this is my favorite. Avram goes to the land of the Plishtim. Remember this whole story? It's the weirdest Avram story. Tell them you're my sister. Remember the story? I suddenly realize you're gorgeous. What's going to be? They're going to kill me. They're going to want you. Tell them you're my sister. So Avimelech says, it's a sister. She's not married. He takes her into the palace and that becomes a mess. Why does Avram do this? Listen to this pasuk. Same verse. Vayomer Avram ki amarti rak ein yirat Elohim b'makom hazeh ve'haraguni al dvar ishti. There is no yirat Elohim in this place. What does yirat Elohim mean? By the way, it's interesting. Sfarno, right? Rashi says, Achsanai sheba la'ir al eskei achila v'shtiya sho'olin ato al eskei ishto sho'olin ato. Somebody who comes and is looking for a place to stay, do they ask him about, you know, whether he wants a good meal, or they ask him about his wife? In other words, there's something totally immoral going on in the city. But the Sfarno makes it much clearer. Listen to the Sfarno. Ein mora malchut. He doesn't talk about a Kosh Baruch. He says, if you don't have respect for the law, if there's no law, if there's no morality, that's a place that has no Yirat Elokim. What does that mean? Yosef, when he tells the brothers, right, that you have to leave one here, and the rest of you can go up, but I'm going to give you food to take with you. And he thinks they're spies. And he's giving them food? How does he justify the fact he gives them food? He says, Et Elohim ani yare. I'm a moral person. And I think the Sfarno understands those two as meaning the same thing. So now listen to this idea, because it's deep. You know, one of the interesting questions is, why do they hate us so much? Why do they hate us? When you read that there are a number of websites you can look this stuff up, and it's instructive to do so. I don't think it's your priority for this year, but it's interesting. What is the biggest problem? What is preventing us from making peace with our cousins? By the way, I do believe that one day we're going to make peace. We're not supposed to make peace with Amalek, but we're going to make peace one day with the Arabs. They're our cousins. There's actually a fascinating commentary of the Pritzadik on the Pasuk of Yishmael. When Avram dies, it says, V'yikberu oto Yitzchak v'Yishmael banav. Yitzchak and Yishmael bury Avram when he dies. They have a rapprochement. They get back together. What's wrong with that Pasuk, by the way? Yitzchak and Yishmael bury Avram. What should it say? Yishmael is older. So Rashi points this out. The Mefarshim talk about this. That Yishmael recognizes his rightful place. He recognizes that he is not taken on. He's not really living up to what Avram wanted of him. And he finds his rightful place, and he recognizes that Judaism, that what Yitzchak represents, is really what we should be thinking. Therefore, he honors Yitzchak by giving him first dibs. And there's this idea that in that moment, the two of them make peace. In fact, Yitzchak, when Rivka is brought up from Paddan Aram to marry Yitzchak, you remember this story? And she's on the camel. Vayetze Yitzchak lasuach basadeh. Right? Yitzchak comes to the field, and he's, where was Yitzchak coming from? Anybody know? Pasuk tells us. Where was Yitzchak coming from? Very unique place. Pasuk there says Yitzchak was coming from a place called Be'er Lachai Ro'i. Now, what was Be'er Lachai Ro'i? That sound familiar to anybody? Look it up, pardon? Exactly right. That is the place where Yishmael, we got the keys here. That was the place where Yishmael was thrown by the Sechim and he almost died. They had a miracle and an angel came and saved him. Remember that story? And Hagar, Ishmael's mother, she's the mother basically of all the Arab nations. She names that place Be'er Lachai Roi. So the commentator says, why is Yitzchak going back to Be'er Lachai Roi? Because after Sarah dies, Yitzchak goes back to Hagar. He gets Hagar. And he brings Hagar back to the home of Avram. And he marries her. And the Medrash says that Hagar has another name, Keturah. And that's who it says that Avram marries. And there's a whole discussion about the fact that Avram marries Keturah and doesn't call her Hagar out of respect for Sarah. There is a rapprochement. They get back together. There will come a day when we learn to live with our cousins. So what's stopping them?
The association of misinformation?
Education. As long as they are educating their children to hate, you can't make peace. Why do they hate us so much? You study the story of the Second World War. It is unbelievable. How many rules Hitler broke strategically? And how many times Hitler could easily have won the war? Easily. I mean, it was madness. Hermann Göring, who was the head of the Luftwaffe and a character in and of himself, and he was caught after the war and tried the Nuremberg trials and committed suicide before they could hang him. He was vehemently against attacking Russia. Because he said, we haven't defeated England yet, and we're going to open up a two-front war. And apparently there's a theory, and there's support for this theory, that the reason Hitler attacks Russia is because Himmler, who was the head of the SS, and really the mastermind of the plan to destroy the Jews, he said, if we want to rid this continent of the Jews, we have to attack Russia, because that's where the Jews are now. There's hundreds of thousands of Jews there. Do you understand this? It was illogical. 1944 in Hungary. There are 500,000 Jews, 500,000 Jews left. It's 1944. You couldn't have a head on your shoulders and not realize that this war was lost. And the reason the war was lost was not because Germany didn't have a superior army. It was because they couldn't arm them. They couldn't arm them. They couldn't get fuel to the troops. They were losing the battle, and the Russians were breaking out of Stalingrad, and they had one simple solution: get them supplies. And they had all the trains to do it. And the industrial areas of the Rhine had not fallen yet. They had enough coal to supply the army. But they needed those trains to take hundreds of thousands of Jews to Auschwitz in the summer of 1944. It makes no sense. Why do they hate us so much? So I'll tell you something. You have to learn to listen to your enemies. Hitler writes a book called Mein Kampf, My Struggle. You've heard of this book. Anybody here read Mein Kampf?
Donald Trump.
Pardon? Could be. So I wouldn't read Mein Kampf instead of the Rambam, and I wouldn't read it instead of the Nitziv. But I think it's good bathroom reading, and I think there's something to be said for understanding why they hated us so much. 50% of this book is, at least from my perspective, is just ramblings. It's not a well-written book. The guy was Meshuggah. But he has moments of clarity, and one of them is he writes very clearly why he hates the Jews, and he writes why he's determined to destroy the Jews. He says that it's time for our Aryan race to reestablish its supremacy in the world. The world needs this. We have to do away with the weak. It's like pruning the tree. The tree grows stronger. That's how nature works. You don't see the weak lion leading the pack because, no, he's like the oldest guy. When he gets weak, they kill him. And that's why the lion packs are so strong. So let's do away with the youth. You know, they had a euthanasia program. Let's do away with the old and the sick and the poor and the Jews. Let's just get rid of the weak. Strong survive. And that makes a lot of sense, except for one thing. There was one people that introduced this idea that undermined everything Hitler wanted to present. And that was the Jews. Because the Jews introduced the idea of God. They introduced this idea of an objective morality. They introduced this idea that might does not make right. You're not necessarily right just because you're stronger. There is an objective right. And Hitler could not forgive the Jews for bringing Hashem into the equation. In fact, Hitler writes, he really wanted to kill God. That's what he wanted to do. It's a crazy idea. That's what he wanted to do. Could never forgive us for bringing Hashem into the equation. That is exactly what happened with Amalek. The entire world was on the cusp of redemption, mystically. The sea split. The Egyptian Empire was vanquished. immorality lost, morality won. The Jewish people received the Torah. The Canaanites were told, you won't be destroyed if you just accept Sheva Mitzvah Ninoch. We were on the edge. Nothing could stop the Jewish people. Until Amalek came along. You know what Amalek introduced into the world? Anybody know what the gematria of Amalek is? Safek. The numeric equivalent of the letters of Amalek is the same as the numeric equivalent of the word Safek. They introduced doubt. Because if Amalek could attack the Jewish people, if they could take prisoners, if they could kill some of them, then maybe God wasn't so awesome. He was just bigger than ours. They introduced doubt. And that doubt, the seed of that doubt, is plaguing us to this very day. That's what Amalek represents. And that has to be destroyed. The position that says that there is no objective morality is the antithesis of everything the world needs to receive. And you have to fight that. Why is something wrong? Is it wrong just because I think it's wrong? What makes something wrong? You know, when I was in high school, I really, really struggled. We're almost done. I really struggled with the question of whether Hashem exists, whether it makes more sense to believe in God, atheism. So I dealt with it the way I used to deal with things. I started reading. And I figured I spent a lot of time reading Jewish stuff. Maybe I should try reading atheist philosophy. So I started reading atheistic philosophy. It wasn't exactly what the Masifta wanted me to be reading, but okay, it was interesting. Bertrand Russell, Jean-Paul Sartre. And I started to realize that atheist philosophy has a problem. They have a number of questions. By the way, this doesn't prove anything. Right? We have our problems too. Maybe we made up God just to solve these problems. But there are certain puzzles that the atheist philosopher has that he can't solve. Right? Bertrand Russell wrote at one point, to believe that the only thing wrong with cruelty is that I don't like it is to believe the absurd. He understood there has to be an objective reason that it's just wrong to do certain things. Right? Anybody here like to play soccer? Okay. Let's say we decide to go play soccer. Hugh Dichter says, I'm going to choose one team, and Gideon says, I'm going to choose the other team. But we got no soccer ball. Judah says, no problem. And he goes outside. He says, I'll get a cat. And he gets a cat, and he rips its head off. We got a soccer ball. And you look at him, and you're like, that's horrendous. How could you do that? You say, what's wrong? We needed a soccer ball. He thinks it's right. What makes it wrong? Bertrand Russell says there has to be something wrong with that. But he couldn't figure out why. Is there an objective? The only way there's an objective morality is if there's an objective source to morality. Only if Hashem decides what's right and wrong can you say there's an objective right or wrong. You say something's wrong because society decides it's wrong. What if society decides what's right is wrong and what's wrong is right? There are portions of society that say they live near here that believe that it's right to kill Jews. That if you sell land in Israel to a Jew, you should be killed. That's crazy. But they think that's right. So what makes it wrong? Only if there's an objective right or wrong. And if right or wrong is not objective, if it's only wrong because I don't like it, that's pretty scary. It's exactly what happened in Nazi Germany. It's exactly what's going on in Iran. It's scary. Amalek introduced that concept. And Judaism says that has to be destroyed. There is a perception that has to be destroyed. Nazi Germany needed to be destroyed. And not only, now, don't get me wrong. We as human beings, without a Navi, we can't make that decision. Rav Soloveitchik believed that Nazi Germany was the reincarnation of Amalek. It's not clear to me whether he believed that halachically or just existentially. But he believed that any nation that rises up to destroy the Jewish people just because we're Jews, because they're fighting what Judaism represents, they're trying to destroy God. Hitler, he believed that was Amalek. And Amalek has to be wiped out. And you know, on the one hand, how could you do it? Only a Kodesh Baruch Hu could tell you to do that. And I'm not suggesting that we should go out and find Nazis and kill them, God forbid. But on the other hand, what if we had done that in 1938? The world would be a different place. And I'll just finish with this idea. You know, if there's no Yirat Elokim, if there's no morality, if you don't, you know, Yirah can come from the root, right? Yareh, which is related to fear. It can also be related to the root Ra'ah, Riyah, to be in awe. Yirat Hashem can also be awe of Hashem, to see Hashem everywhere. If you could so see that Hashem runs the world, there are certain things you could never do. And it's a source of morality. You can't embarrass another human being when you recognize he's created in the image of Hashem. And the antithesis of that is amalek, is suffering, is to doubt that Hashem exists, to doubt that it makes sense, to doubt that there's an objective morality, and everything else in between. And if you can erase that doubt from your mind, then you will have destroyed amalek in your soul. We're entering deeper into the world of Elul. We're approaching Rosh Hashanah. And we each of us have to ask ourselves, what are the things that we want to make room for? And what are the things that we want to let go of? What are the seeds we want to plant? And what are the roots that we want to destroy? And every one of us has all of those inside of himself. And there's a wisdom, and you have to be very careful with this, because if you destroy the wrong things, they will become destructive. There is an aspect of amalek that we can destroy if we figure out what it is. You know? To destroy the ability to embarrass another person, which creates doubt about the validity of a human being. To destroy the ability to get angry. To destroy the ability to be lazy. Right? All of that is also figure out what are the enemies that you have in your life. What are the things that bring you down? And do battle with them. Overcome them. And we'll be in a better place. So, Hashem should bless us all. First of all, the Donald Felber should have a refuah shleimah and be healthy, Bezrat Hashem. And his family should celebrate his health, Bezrat Hashem, soon. And we, Bezrat Hashem, should have an incredible month. This was just an incredible week. And it was inspiring to see all of you and the way you learned and how much you put into this week. You finished a full week of learning Torah in the Old City of Yerushalayim as your first. There are many more to come. And bless you, Bezrat Hashem, that as great as this week was, next week should be even better. Shabbat Shalom.